Guardian Unlimited.
I'm Alok Jha, and this is Science Weekly for January the 14th. Coming up on this week's podcast, we discuss dream dinner party lineups with Caspar Melville, editor of the New Humanist magazine. He'd have Charles Darwin at the head of his table. Who would you choose? Also in the show, we talk game theory and social physics with Nobel Prize winner Roger Myerson. Plus, Arpad Pushtai, the scientist who kickstarted a controversy over the safety of GM foods almost a decade ago. And we'll tell you how to make the world a better place. It's really not that hard. This is Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. Hello again, listeners, and welcome back to a pod that's variously been described as exceptional, inspiring, and pubbery. Your panel this week begins with Guardian science correspondent James Randerson. Looking sharp, JR.
Ouch.
But who said science was all about the beards? In what must be a pod first, we've got two female panellists on the pod this week. Nell Bowes from Guardian's arts team is back in business. Still no cake, though, Nell.
It's coming soon.
Good stuff. And Bryony Greenhill is the creator of the Nag.net, which just won the Best Ethical Website at the Yahoo Find of the Year Awards. Hello, Bryony.
Hello.
More on your website later. And believe me when I say the pleasure is all ours. If you could have a dinner party with four guests from the past or present, who would they be? Well, our special guest this week asked just that. He's Caspar Melville, editor of the New Humanist magazine. And in the latest issue, he's put together an account of just such an occasion. His diners were Charles Darwin, geneticist Steve Jones, evolutionary biologist Jerry Coyne, and our very own James Randerson. We'll gloss over James's participation. Seriously, though, his table manners are very bad. But Caspar, first of all, welcome to the pod.
Thank you.
Tell us a bit about the project. Why did you bring this group together?
Well, it wasn't one of those what would be your favourite dinner party guess ideas. The idea was if Charles Darwin, you know, came back, they found a piece of him in amber in the Galapagos and they brought him back, who could I bring to meet him and talk to him who knew something about him and would have interesting questions to ask him?
And you chose James. Let's leave that behind.
Well, you know, you actually missed one out. There's also John Van Vira, who runs Darwin Online, and he's a bifellow at Christ College in Cambridge. He's a historian. So what I did was I got a geneticist, a historian, a biologist, and a journalist to put together a series of questions about what they would ask Charles Darwin if they were lucky enough to come to dinner, what they would tell him, what they would bring him, and what they thought the evening would be like.
So take us through some of the answers. What was your favourite?
I mean, I learned so much from this, and among the many things I learned were about what Charles Darwin got wrong. I mean, the idea behind the project really came out of the fact that Charles Darwin, or Darwin in particular, has been defended against creationism so much recently, and Darwinists have perhaps felt under attack and therefore have elevated Darwin to this great height. And all we hear about is how right he was about everything. But leaving aside the ridiculous creationist and ID arguments, we wanted to look at what had changed in evolutionary theory over the 150 years since he wrote Origin of the Species, roughly, and have people ask him questions about things which they still didn't understand about what he said, and also tell him things that had happened. So in many ways, the most moving thing that was said was what Steve Jones said about he would like to talk to him about genes, because Darwin didn't know anything about genes. So in fact, he came up with the idea of natural selection without understanding the mechanism. And it was always a big gap in his theory. And the way Steve Jones put it is so moving, because he said, I would like to tell Darwin that we discovered the way in which this process happened. And it actually confirmed, in a way that Darwin himself had not anticipated, how right he was about this process.
Darwin was a bit worried about it, wasn't he? Steve Jones talks about how he had several accounts, so he republished The Origin of Species several times, each time watering it down.
He watered it down. He was the most confident in the first edition, and by the sixth edition, he was, you know, hedging his bets and prevaricating. Steve Jones mentions one particular case where an engineer called Fleming Jenkins, I think, wrote to him and said that they thought that this mixing process happened through the blood. Darwin thought that. And he said, using the idea of the blood, if you mix two colours together, like in blood, wouldn't they just dilute? How could you then recover the preferential factors to carry them through time? Now, what Steve Jones says is it's not liquid that we're talking about here. It's genes, and genes are a sort of digital system. They're not an analog system. So you can, for example, mix blue eyes and brown eyes and get brown eyes, and then blue eyes back. It's not a question of dilution. And so this would have resolved a huge problem that Darwin had at the heart of his theory.
He also mentions that the genetics obviously comes from Mendel's ideas.
Yes.
And that he'd been sent Mendel's ideas but hadn't read them.
Yeah, I know. It's amazing, isn't it? I mean, what Jones said, which I didn't really have space to put in here, is one of the reasons why people did not take them that seriously is they were written in the most arcane form. He says you can only now understand what they say because you know what they say. So what happened was Mendel sent them around and most people either didn't pick them up or read them or didn't understand them. And it's quite possible that Darwin wouldn't have understood the impact that this would have had or wouldn't have thought it was an interesting question. No one figured out or put together the two ideas until much later on in the early 20th century when I think it was a mathematician at the UCL put the two ideas together, Mendelism and Darwinism, and realised that the one confirmed the other. They were not in contradiction.
Well, it's good to see that the greatest scientific ideas sometimes are subject to the comedy of errors. James, you're in your answers to this, you also sort of went along Steve Jones's line showing that DNA and genetics are what proved his idea. What made you think that? Why would you want to tell him that?
Well, I just thought that Darwin would be fascinated to see the structure of DNA and understand the genetic code. And also, one thing in particular I thought he'd be particularly interested in would be the fact that there's a universal code, almost entirely universal, all the way from bacteria to elephants, which suggests that there's a common origin for life, which was something that Darwin was arguing for. But I thought that I was really interested in John Van Wy's answer, where he was saying that the spin on Darwin that society has put on the great man over the years has changed. I don't know if that sort of caught your fancy.
Oh, utterly
as well.
Fascinating. I mean, John Van Vera seems to be making a career out of exploding the myths that attach to Darwin. And he has a very interesting, I didn't have space for his full answer, but he said there's a kind of punctuated equilibrium about the way in which Darwin is discussed historically. Every time there's an anniversary, you know, the 25 years, the 50 years of the publication or of his birth or his death, a new idea about him comes. And the two ones that he's punctured recently, one is about Darwin's finches. Everyone knows about Darwin's finches and how important they were. Absolute rubbish, he says. The problem with Darwin's finches is when he went to the Galapagos, he was a young researcher and a bit casual, and he did not tightly record where he'd picked up the different birds from, and therefore they did not provide the kind of evidence that he was looking for.
Where did that idea come from then?
Do you know? I mean, John has written about this in great detail. He actually picks out particular books which have put this idea forward from the 40s to the 60s to the 70s. The other big idea was the idea that Darwin suppressed his theory for a long time because he was afraid of the impact he was going to have, the so-called gap. And he has definitively exploded this idea as well. And he just says, if you look at the way Darwin talks about his work, it took a hell of a long time to put the stuff together. He cogitated on it a lot. And he, in certain of his remarks, he says to some young researchers, you know, I regret moving too swiftly at some time from the facts to a sort of theoretical overview before I'd really marshalled all my facts. And he says it's quite plausible that it took him a long time to put his idea together.
So even Darwin thought he was moving too quickly.
Well, what he did was he made some speculations about geology in Wales, where he went walking in Wales, which turned out to be massively wrong. And he was embarrassed by that. And because he was so scrupulous, and as Steve Jones says, that rare thing, an honest scientist, he never wanted to experience that again. So he really, really worked hard on this stuff. And he kept on being distracted. I mean, Van Vera's got this wonderful stuff about barnacles, because Darwin was just about to prepare the origin of the species. He had the idea written down in sketch, but it wasn't written as a book. And he says, I'm just about to get to it, but I've got to do barnacles first. He got fascinated by barnacles. And he spent 7 or 8 years, you know, studying barnacles, and he got completely overwhelmed. He starts off talking about my beloved barnacles. He's fascinated. And by the end, by 5 years down the line, they're these accursed barnacles. But if you study biology now and you're interested in barnacles, you read Darwin on barnacles. He's absolutely the go-to guy. So in that way, Van Vera explodes the idea that he was moving in one area and shows that he actually moved across an enormous amount of areas all at once, following his interest and his scientific kind of bent.
Two of your respondents, Steve Jones and John Van Wy, responded about what they would show Darwin, and it was life on Earth. David Attenborough's life on Earth.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you think Darwin might have learnt from that program? I mean, it's
fascinating. Well, just imagine. I mean, my six-year-old son has seen more natural history, more animals, more intimate animal, you know, idea about animals and their nature than Darwin could have ever had access to. You know, I mean, I've seen penguins, you know, flying out of the water to escape from leopard seals because of David Attenborough. Darwin never saw that. You've been up in the canopy. You've been in very fine. I mean, you know, later on in this current issue, Laurie Taylor interviews David Attenborough and tells David Attenborough that Steve Jones would have given it to Darwin. And you know, David Attenborough was enormously pleased, of course, because he always says, I'm not a scientist, I'm just a broadcaster. But I really think Attenborough, absolutely, both in his temperament, the fact he's a great guy, and the fact that he's an honest man and has made the most fantastic impact on our public understanding of science. So that seems perfectly appropriate. I mean, other people had wacky ideas, like someone wanted to bring him Star Wars and said it was a magnificent film, but you know, you can't, there's no accounting for taste.
as
someone said, you know, he's going to need some downtime.
I just thought it was going to be a heavy evening for him. You know, what can I say?
I love the idea. Rather going to bed, you go, I'll just sit down with four episodes of long films.
Six, my friend.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No.
Two of them are illegitimate.
Oh, I see. Let me ask a few other members of the pod then. Who else you'd have at this dream dinner party? We've had Charles Darwin and this fantastic bunch of people talking about the what they would ask him. But, you know, Nell, who would be at your dinner party, a scientist from the past or even present?
Well, the thing I loved about this idea was that having somebody at the head of your dinner table who's you've had time to develop their theory. So I reckon you need somebody like Tycho Brahe, who's where you can go right back and find out about all the kind of court intrigue and the religious intrigue of the solar system and studying the stars. And also find out why he had a silver note.
So two people, Charles Darwin and Tycho Brahe, who basically sort of undermined religion and made our place
universe. Tycho didn't undermine it. He just made it possible for you to kind of study it without definitely undermining it.
Bryony, do you have any favourite people you'd have on these dinner parties or table? Have you ever thought about this?
Not being a particular science head, but I think I would invite Susan Greenfield largely because I haven't ever got around to reading her books.
And I'd much rather have a conversation with her.
You're lazy.
Susan, can you pray see your books for me, please?
Yes. Susan, quickly.
And answer all my questions while I'm here. Because, you know, if you ask a question of a book, you often have to wait several chapters before it's answered. Whereas if you ask the person, it's, you know, it's a more immediate response. So.
You should be a journalist.
Now, what would you make for Tycho Brahe? Something not particularly smelly, I'm assuming. He hasn't got a nose.
I don't know. Oh, there's an amazing pie I make that is kind of cardamom and pistachio, and it looks like the surface of Jupiter.
Why don't you just bring that into the...
I'll bring you one next week.
All right, well, obviously, very soon is the 149th anniversary of the Beagle trip. So next year, 150, hopefully we'll still be podcasting back then. Casper, thank you for all of this. You can read more about this story at newhumanist.org.uk. Casper's staying in the pod for the rest of the show. Much obliged, of course. If you've got something to say about Darwin's dinner party, or perhaps you want to suggest your own dream lineup, post your comments on the Science Blog or our Facebook wall. I'm Alok Jha. You're listening to Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. Still to come, we'll be finding out about making the world a better place with our guest, Bryony Greenhill, creator of thenag.net. Plus,
understanding it both in physical and social sciences at the most fundamental and theoretical level has a very useful role to play, enabling us to manage human affairs better for a better future.
We discuss game theory, science, and economics with Nobel Prize winner Roger Myerson. That's all coming up, or if you're feeling really clever, you could fast forward and come back to this bit soon in a spatiotemporal something or other. Because first, it's time to get up to date with the rest of the week's science news. Here's James and Nell with the News Jam.
News Jam.
Millions of Britons could be playing Russian roulette with their health by regularly buying prescription drugs on the internet. The Royal Pharmaceutical Society warned that up to 50% of all drugs seized proved to be counterfeit. A spokesperson said that dishonest traders were selling medicines online without any professional qualifications or healthcare expertise.
We should spend more time in the sun. That's the advice from a new study which looked at the health benefits of vitamin D, which is produced by the skin when it's exposed to sunshine. People with higher levels of vitamin D were more likely to survive cancers such as those of the colon, breast and lung. But concerns over skin cancer and a lack of vitamin D in our diets mean that people may not be getting the full benefits of the nutrient.
Astronomers have created the most detailed map yet of the mysterious dark matter that fills much of the space between galaxies. Scientists use the Hubble Space Telescope to image a supercluster of galaxies that is 2.6 billion light-years from Earth. Before reaching Hubble, the light from these galaxies was bent by gravity, and studying this distortion allowed scientists to work out the distribution of the dark matter.
And finally, good news for drinkers. People who enjoy a tipple have a 30% lower risk of heart disease than teetotalers, and those who combine alcohol with regular exercise are even less likely to die of the disease. They have a 50% lower risk than couch potatoes who abstain from alcohol.
Thank you, James and Nell. Let's pick up on a few of those. James, exercise and alcohol. Does this research suggesting that exercise and alcohol are both good for me mean that if I drink a pint of beer whilst I'm running, that somehow I'm going to be amazingly fit?
That is the perfect combination.
Is it?
Yes.
Tell us more.
Although you might spill some of it. This is a kind of recurring story in a way, the kind of booze is good for you. But there is actually now quite a lot of evidence that alcohol in moderation is not too bad for you and is actually good for your heart. This particular study is from Denmark, nearly 12,000 people who were studied over the course of a couple of decades. So it's a pretty good study. They've started off at the beginning, said, you know, what kind of exercise do you do? How much do you drink? Other lifestyle factors like smoking, etc. Unfortunately, they didn't look at diet, so that might be a kind of factor that they didn't bring in. But nonetheless, they've come out with it. If you're a moderate drinker, then on average you're 30% lower risk of heart disease, and that combined with exercise takes you to a 50% lower risk. So, you know, it's good news.
And what if you don't drink at all?
Well, if you don't drink at all, then you know, if you don't drink at all, it's better if you exercise than if you don't exercise. But either way, it's better if you drink a bit. And moderate drinking is, less than 14 units a week.
How many pints is that? It's about
Five or six pints a week.
Rather than a night. Nell, you've got a question?
I was just wondering what exactly it is that the alcohol's doing. Do they know this?
Well, the idea is that it's something to do with playing around with the levels of good and bad cholesterol. It's the bad cholesterol which leads to heart disease, and it somehow lowers them.
Nell, fake drugs.
The top ones are Prozac and Viagra, Valium, Ritalin, which is often used by people wanting to slim, Seristim, which are used by bodybuilders wanting to bulk up, and Provigil, which is a treatment for narcolepsy that students use to keep awake and things like that.
Well, what happened to Pro Plus? That's what I used to use to stay awake when I was younger.
It's more serious stuff now.
Soldiers use Provigil as well. Has anyone here bought anything on the internet, drugs-wise? Well, you sound very sensible people, all of you.
I'm really, really shocked to hear that some of the drugs that they're selling on the internet are really not right. I mean,
what do you mean?
No wonder all parts of my body have stayed exactly the same size, despite my best efforts.
£20 for a pack of 30 Prozac.
Get some money back on that bodybuilding drug.
James, the Rogaine clearly hasn't worked then, that you've been ordering. Okay.
But yeah. they're going to put a little logo on each Pucker website so that you can tell when you're buying whether you're don't go by more than just the price.
Okay, well, people need to be careful there. I want to move on to sunbathing. Are we all sunbathers here at all? No? In the winter, probably not, maybe. But so, no, sunbathing and vitamin D. So the researchers here in the States here, they realise that not enough of us are getting enough vitamin D. This is stuff, obviously, we all know, useful for keeping bones healthy, but also, it turns out, for protecting you against various cancers, internal cancers, colon cancer, lung cancer, breast cancer. And we're just not getting enough of it because basically we're staying inside too much. Our lives are changing. We're not getting enough of it in our food. So you get it in oily fish and milk and that kind of thing. And so what these guys are suggesting is perhaps we should step outside a bit more, get a bit more sun. Of course, the corollary to this is step outside for too long and you might have melanoma, which is one of the worst cancers in the world.
What's the actual evidence here? Is this like an epidemiological study?
What they did was to model how much sunlight a person is exposed to on average, depending on where they live in the world, depending on latitude, and they reduced a person down to a cylinder effectively and looked at the amount of sunlight they're getting. And they found that, for example, in Australia, people are making more vitamin D from sunlight than obviously in the northern climes like the UK and Scandinavia. And they had more incidence of things like colon cancer and so on. But they survived these cancers more. They studied several thousand people to work this out. And they therefore concluded that the vitamin D must have been having some sort of protective effect because they factored out most other things. And the vitamin D, they reckon, they must have had some sort of protective effect. And it's not just that. I mean, there's been huge amounts of evidence for the past decade now that vitamin D has an effect in all sorts of things, from cardiovascular disease. Actually, on the same day in another journal, Harvard Medical School scientists looked at something like 1,800 people from the Framingham Heart Study and found that those with lower vitamin D levels had increased cardiovascular disease. But it's not only cardiovascular disease, it's immune diseases, all sorts of things where vitamin D is incredibly important. I think that they could have just worked it out by the name. In fact, it's called vitamin something. Vitamins are always good for you, aren't they? But what do you all think about this?
Not too much.
What do you all think about this?
we've all kind of been scared of the sun a little bit. You know, don't go out in the sun, put sunblock on, don't let your kids out anywhere. I mean, do you think that encouraging people to go out more is a slightly suspect thing to do, or should we just eat? Bryony.
I think there's a very big difference between spending 8 hours a day in the sun in a bikini and things like cycling to work, stepping outside at lunchtime and having your lunch in a park. My bike broke for a week, a couple of weeks before Christmas, and I became so depressed in the week because I was sort of sitting on a bus for hours, and it was just a very annoying experience. And even though I wasn't even underground, I felt that I didn't have any time outside. And in the winter, it feels...
It's even worse.
Vital for your, I mean, I'm not sure what my body's doing in terms of vitamin D, but in terms of my mental well-being, it was damaged by just not whizzing around on a bike, you know, for maybe an hour a day in the sunlight.
Casper, what do you think? Do you get out in the sun more, a lot?
Well, I get outside a lot, and today I stepped out quite a lot, but I just got soaked, so...
not good.
Yeah, I mean, I am actually, when I can, I'm a sun worshipper. I mean, I adore being on a beach, you know, all day long. I don't particularly like lying down, you know, but I like being around in a beach, but I burn. I'm quite light-skinned, and I do burn, and I did get afraid of, you know, the consequences for my skin, and I do slather my sun with high-factor sun cream. But I think being out in the sun, I mean, this reminds me a little bit of the research about, you know, depression and lack of sunlight. I've always claimed for myself that I suffer from, you know, sad disease or whatever you call it when you
don't... Seasonal affective disorder.
See, that's the one. So probably there's no scientific evidence for this, but it seemed to me there might be a link between the idea that sunlight's good for you, makes you feel good, warms you, you know, makes you... And I think being outside as much as you can is an essential thing. And I'm a bike rider as well, so...
Can I just check with the scientists? So if you put on sun cream, it blocks the UV rays, but you still produce vitamin D.
It depends what the sun cream is.
Oh.
And it depends what rays are getting through, because it's the UVB rays, which also cause melanoma, that also switch on your vitamin D. But the thing to take away from all of this is not to, as you say, Bryony, not to sit outside in a bikini for 8 hours a day. The Cancer Research UK, when I talked to them about this, they said that... you should go outside, you should get sun, but the amount of vitamin D you produce by stepping outside is always less than tanning. So if you've tanned, you've produced enough vitamin D. You don't need to go out and get yourself tanned. So you can still do safe sort of sun worshipping, as it were. We'll leave that one there. But James, before we wind up the news jam, give me some angry Randerson.
Well, this is just a mini rant.
There's nothing mini about your rants. Go on.
It's
go full fledged.
On behalf of Colin Blakemore, just because he was passed over again for an honour in the New Year's
Honours. Remind
people
who Colin Blakemore is.
I was getting there.
All right.
Ex-head of the Medical Research Council and sort of biomedical researcher. Now, he's adopted a very kind of controversial position over the years on animal testing, and at one time, I mean, he uses animals in his own research, and at one time he told me, you know, he was spending kind of 80% of his sort of professional time advocating animal research. Now, this was at the time in the 90s when that was a position that very few scientists, even though there are thousands of scientists who do that kind of work in the UK, very few scientists would actually put their heads above the parapet and talk about it. And you can understand why, because his own experience is having, you know, people arriving in the middle of the night and throwing things through his windows and sending bombs through his letterbox and things like that. And the weird thing is that because he's taken this controversial stance, it appears that the honours establishment, whoever they are, have decided that it would be too controversial to give him an award, and I think that's a real shame.
There's something weird about this particular year as well. Sir Ian Wilmot, the creator of Dolly the Sheep, he got a...
Clearly uses animals,
and he got a knighthood this time around.
He doesn't... I suspect the difference is that Wilmot doesn't go out and kind of, you know, talk about the benefits of animal research. I mean, I'm sure he would espouse those benefits, but it's not his sort of big thing, is it?
What does everyone else think? I mean, Colin Blakemore, beyond talking about animal research and its various benefits, I mean, he's done a lot for medical research in his country as head of the Medical Research Council. Do people like him deserve honours, Nell?
I don't see why not, although I'm not entirely sure that honours mean as much nowadays as they have in the past.
I think it's a principle
thing.
I'm not sure
that it's one thing that you want to get riled up about.
No, I mean, I'm sure that you know, in a real world, it doesn't make any difference. But you know, the fact is that it's slightly hypocritical for a government that's supposed to be pro-science. And in fact, Tony Blair himself, when he was Prime Minister, if you remember those days, he went on about how we should face down extremists and all of this. And I think...
I mean, I'm not a massive fan of the honours system per se or whatever, but it just seems that in this case he's being deliberately snubbed. I mean, every other previous head of the MRC, now the MRC is the biggest public research funding body. They have a budget of something like 300, 400 million, I think. And, you know, it seems weird to kind of make a point of not giving him one. If that's the way, you know, we as a society decide to honour people, then... You know, it's just strange.
Searing insight as always, James. You can comment on any of this stuff, of course, at our blog, blogs.guardian.co.uk/science. Over the past few months, we've discussed the field of social physics with a number of distinguished guests. You'll remember that Philip Ball and Mark Buchanan explained how mathematical and scientific principles could perhaps make sense of the randomness of human behaviour. Well, we've got another angle. Roger Myerson is one of the world's leading authorities on game theory, and he's written extensively on whether science and economics can predict social trends. Last year, he won the Nobel Prize in Economics, which, if we return to our main topic this week, makes him a pretty good candidate for a dinner party conversation. Yeah, I know, very Guardian. James met with Professor Myerson recently and began by asking him how game theory applies to real life.
One of the things we find, for example, in the most elementary of game theory models is that a kind of randomness is forced on us. For example, if everyone wants to back a winner in a political campaign, then there's a possibility that just because some minor event makes everyone think that a particular candidate doesn't have a chance, now all the donors and supporters that might have backed him invest instead in some other candidate who then wins. So there's a kind of multiplicity of equilibria that I think is very much a part of everything I see about social theory at the most fundamental level tells me that human affairs must have a certain multiplicity of equilibrium. There's a certain arbitrary events that because we all think they're important, they become important to us.
Does
and conversely, kind of random, there are other games where randomized strategies are inevitable, and therefore, in some sense, the winner in a tennis match, you can't predict whether he's going to serve to the left side of the box or the right side of the box, because if you could predict, then the other side would adjust in such a way that the server would want to do the other, or in a soccer penalty kick. So randomness is a part of social life. What we can do much better at is asking, how do changes in institutional rules, reform of our social institutions, how do they help? And, for example, if we're going to build institutions to regulate global warming, how are we going to begin to build such international institutions? We can sharpen the questions greatly.
So even though these things are very difficult to predict because of those random events, we can sort of bolster our institutions, for example, making a much better European emissions trading scheme,
yes,
or whatever.
That's the kind of thing we can do. But we can't predict how political boundaries will have changed 100 years from now. That there's no way science is going to go in that direction.
So you're not going to tell us if it's Clinton or Obama then?
Oh, no. Again, if I could. And I can tell you it was remarkable to me in the 2004 presidential election, I think millions of voters who were partisans of the Democratic Party wanted the most electable candidate, which made a very predictable event that whoever got the most votes in the very first primary would look more electable, and then everyone would want to vote for that person. And in about 7 nanoseconds, the Democratic electorate had converged behind John Kerry. I could tell you how to reform voting systems so that perhaps we wouldn't have had to do that. Perhaps by an approval voting instead of a single positive voting system, the incentives for that might have been moderated. But it was very predictable to me. But that the Democratic Party was going to converge very quickly. But of course, I have no way of knowing who, nor did anybody else.
It's been a while since we've read out your feedback on the show. Most of what you've been saying has been particularly kind, though, so thanks for that, especially if, like our listeners Athelstan and Affront, you're new to what we do here on Science Weekly. Anyway, without much further ado, here's what you've been telling us. Asen Sviatkov, who's probably our first Bulgarian listener, says...
A very inspiring show. I wish there was more quality podcasts like this. Please keep up the great work.
Whilst Cyril reckons...
Having listened to these shows for a while and enjoyed them, I decided to register in order to say I think the latest show was exceptional. Every item was worth listening to. I especially enjoyed the discussion with Stephen Phelps. A pity it did not go on for longer. Perhaps you could get him back.
Thing is, we can't tell whether you're being sarcastic, Si. Anyway, Brandy Jefferson, which is possibly a dish we could serve at our fictional dinner party, says she just can't get enough. Calm down, Producer Ben. Quick word on the length of the shows, by the way. They've been nudging the 38-minute mark over the past few weeks. And well, it turns out that's pretty much exactly the time it takes producer Ben and me to walk to work. Not together, you understand. Our relationship is strictly professional, even though he has had a shave and dyed his hair red again this week. So until one of us moves, the show will continue to be around that length. Hopefully it fits in with your commute too. Quickly play a sting, Ben. Moving on to something a bit more scientific. Arpad Pushtai is a protein scientist and one of the world's foremost experts on plant lectins. Well, he has written 270 papers and three books on the subject. In 1998, Pushtai began a scientific furore when he claimed that his experiments showed how genetically modified potato had caused harm to rats. The outburst led to his dismissal from the Rowett Research Institute in Aberdeen, where he'd been working, and the resulting controversy over the validity of his research continued unabated for years, irreparably damaging the reputation of GM science in the UK. In Tuesday's Education Guardian, you'll be able to read a rare interview with Pushtai about the controversy. A decade on, he tells us what really happened all those years ago. By the magic of podcasting, you'll also be able to listen to it as this week's Science Extra. Here's a taster.
The reason for it is very simple. I was publicly funded, and I thought that the public has a right to know.
Public have a right to know once work has gone through the publication process?
No, not necessarily. At the time when I spoke, for a year and a half, we were eating something that has never been properly tested. It has been smuggled in a sense, under the counter. Make no mistake about it. This is an irreversible technology. It's no good if 50 years later we'll say, oh, yeah, we should have known better.
Still passionate there, Arpad Pushtai. Will you be having GM potatoes at your dream dinner party? Make your own mind up. The interview's available to download as this week's Science Extra. Head back to the blog, Facebook or iTunes for more details. Let's finish this week by talking about something a bit environmental, a bit technological, but all round ethical. The Nag.net just won one of the top prizes at this year's Finds of the Year competition, an annual search for the most innovative and strangest contributions to the web from the UK. Other award winners included a canine social networking site, a way of improving your vocabulary whilst preventing starvation, and a guide to moving home. But we're not going to talk about them today. You've been hearing from her throughout the show, and now, Bryony, the pod is yours. Tell us about the Nag.net. What does it do?
Well, it's a site designed for everybody who wants to make their lifestyle a bit greener, wants to be part of the solution to climate change, part of the solution to poverty, but doesn't really know where to start, or if they do, don't really ever quite get round to it, because there's always a bit too many other things to do in life. So, in response to those kind of needs, we've created the Nag. You sign up, you become a member. Each month you get an email nagging you to come and visit the site. Once there, you get taken step by step through doing one thing to change your lifestyle, like switching to green energy, getting an ethical bank account, signing up to a food box, that sort of thing.
How often do you get these emails?
Once a month.
You said that already, didn't I? Yeah. That's a rubbish question.
Only once a month.
Tell us about your background. I mean, how did you get involved in the whole project?
I studied world politics at university, and I became very interested in the relationship between Western consumption and production and both climate change and international development. And it seemed to me that there was a lot of work going on at the governmental level. There was a lot of work going on with businesses to slowly change our consumption and production and make it more sustainable. But not much work was happening at the cultural level and at the level of personal community behaviour change. So that was where I felt I really wanted to focus my efforts.
So green issues are big for a lot of people, and this just makes it a bit easier for them to go ahead and do their various
Absolutely.
Green contributions.
Yeah. And on top of that, we then show what everybody's doing. So we've got technology that maps action all around the country and shows borough by borough, county by county, who's switching to green energy, how much carbon it's saving. Because I think one of the big barriers to a lot of people actually making that step is a sense that, oh, my little action, it's not going to make a difference. It's just a drop in the ocean. The more that we can show that hundreds of people, thousands of people around the country are starting to do this, you start to make a new social norm visible and you start to create a sense that I'm a part of a big and powerful and growing movement for change.
Can these people contact each other? I mean, is it a bit like Facebook for greenies?
It's becoming more and more so, and there's a lot of work happening under the bonnet at the moment to make that easier.
One thing that I'm always curious about with these sorts of grassroots initiatives is that things that are environmentally friendly are not necessarily ethically friendly at the same time. People confuse the two things together, so they think that anything ethical is also environmentally friendly. For example, buying your bananas from a certain country might have an incredibly large carbon footprint, but it is the most ethical thing to do in terms of keeping that particular, those farmers, in money and so on. How do you square those two things together?
Developing each NAG, we go through quite a big research process where we do a lot of user research with people. We find out where our users are at in terms of their attitudes and their behaviour. But we also speak to a lot of different experts in the field and try and balance up these environmental, these economic, these social concerns. And I guess the whole project of sustainability is about finding a balance between those three things. And so we tend to strike a balance. Often it's just quite simple because, say, the one thing that everybody is prepared to do, is the pro-environmental thing. So we say, well, the one that's kind of really going to help economically isn't acceptable to people, so we'll go with the environmental one because that's the most doable. But I also think people can get a bit finickety about it. It's like, it doesn't matter. If some people are buying fair trade, some people are buying local, some people are buying organic, that's all good. I mean, I think the way that we need to be thinking as a society is about what are the kind of labels that we want 10 years from now that actually encompass all of the sustainability pillars underneath them in one thing.
If you know what you're doing, you can make those active choices, but your heart has to be the right place in the first place, I guess. Mm-hmm. James, what about you?
I want to ask actually, how many people have you got?
We've got 5,000 members. We haven't really had much of a marketing budget.
But you're going to get millions out of this.
Yeah.
You're going to get millions out of this.
And I mean, there's more to it than just an email that says, right, switch to low energy light bulbs. Yeah. Try and make, give some practical advice?
We really hold people's hands. We really take you step by step through. For example, if you're switching to green energy, we say, well, here are the companies that we really recommend, and here's a link to their websites, and here are the companies we don't recommend, and here are the reasons why, and here's what to do if you have an electricity prepayment meter, and a lot of questions answering, a lot of taking people through all the steps they need to go through, and
I sort of slightly disagree with something that you said earlier on about it's okay if people are doing organic or people are doing that and people are doing something else, because I think there's a danger here that through consumption in particular, people can have a good feeling about, oh, okay, I'm buying organic food, so I'm doing my bit and that's fine. When actually, if they're buying organic food that's shrink wrapped and has been flown from South Africa, then I don't think it is fine. So I don't know. I think going into the details is kind of important sometimes.
I think it's hugely important, but we live in a very imperfect world. So a lot of people are upset about beans from Kenya because of the carbon, because it's about 10 times their own weight in carbon dioxide that is emitted when they're flown over from Kenya. But people who live in Kenya will tell you that there's a massive debate in Kenya about the local environmental impact and the local health impact of the non-organic production of these beans. So it's like, if you really got to have those beans, better to have them organic. But I guess that's why, in the box section, we promote getting a box which is local and organic and very low packaging. And we look as much as possible for solutions that join up all the three needs. But yeah, there's no conclusion there, really. But no,
well, I think you're right. It's an imperfect world, isn't it? It's very hard to.
Sorry, Casper, I cut you off a bit too quickly there. But you were going to say, are you going to sign up to the NAG on it as soon as you get out of this podcast studio?
Yeah, I will. I mean, I haven't heard of it. I'll definitely give it a shot. And I could do with, some guidance on these sort of things, because, I'm obviously happy to make these kind of consumer choices if they suit me, but I do find it very confusing. I saw a guy on the TV trying to explain why his company was fishing prawns out of the sea in Scotland and shipping them over to Thailand to be stripped and then brought back here. And he said, well, we don't have the machinery doing it, and so there's less carbon. And I thought, well, even if there's less carbon, it just can't be right. It just doesn't make sense. But, what do I know? So I need some help to think through some of these issues. And I mean, is there a way that you can pose questions to the NAG? And
that's also happening under the bonnet at the moment.
Okay, because I would really appreciate
that.
Watch this space, indeed. So that's the NAG.net. Well, we are done for another week. My thanks to everyone in the pod, James Randerson, Nell Bowes, Bryony Greenhill from the NAG.net, and our special guest, New Humanist Magazine's Casper Melville. We'll put links to both of those sites on the blog. Speaking of which, if you want to add your thoughts and opinions about anything you've heard on the show, head to blogs.guardian.co.uk/science or post a comment on the Facebook wall. And because we're nice like that, how about listening to our new spin-off shows, Tech Weekly and Environment Weekly? You'll find them and the rest of the Guardian audio output at guardian.co.uk/podcasts. Science Weekly has been produced by Ben Green. I've been Alok Chah, and I thought that went all right today, don't you?
Guardian Unlimited.